You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On March 10th, 2016, Rick Britton presented the third lecture in our four-part CPN Thursday series entitled Jefferson's Legacies. Following his death, the Jefferson estate fell into the hands of private owners. In this podcast, you will learn how the United States' third president's home, Monticello, came to be a public place in honor of its most famous resident. Rick Britton is an historian of the Old Dominion who specializes in 18th and 19th century Virginia history. Two of his main areas of expertise are the American Civil War and the life and times of our third president, Thomas Jefferson. Along with his writing, Rick conducts tours of Civil War battlefields, teaches classes on the history of Central Virginia, organizes history programming for the Senior Center in Charlottesville, illustrates maps and history books, and lectures all across Virginia on a wide range of topics. With over 200 published articles and essays under his belt, he's the author of Albemarle and Charlottesville, an Illustrated History, and Jefferson, a Monticello Sampler, for which he was awarded a medal for nonfiction at New York City Book Expo, the nation's largest book convention. His newest book, Virginia Vignettes, Volume 1, Famous Characters and Events in Central Virginia History, is the first of a new series featuring some of the men and women who figure large in 18th and 19th century American history. The lecture was presented by Rick Britton as a part of this series and was held in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Our podcast is entitled Jefferson's Legacies, The Founding of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation. Here's Rick Britton.
Mrs. Martin W. Littleton, wife of prominent New York Democratic representative, stood in the crowd in Arlington National Cemetery anxious to see the monument about to be dedicated to Washington architect Pierre Charles L'Enfant. A sea of white headstones completely flooded the surrounding field. The year was 1911. As the speakers droned on, President William H. Taft, New York Senator Elihu Root, and the French ambassador to the United States, Littleton's eyes wandered across the wide Potomac to the marble-faced obelisk honoring the father of our country. George Washington had been memorialized, and now L'Enfant was receiving his due, thought Mrs. Littleton, but nowhere in, quote, this glorious temple of trees and marble, unquote, was there reserved a spot for Thomas Jefferson. Something must be done. In August of that year, Mrs. Littleton published an emotionally charged open letter to the nation. And if you get a chance, go over to the Jefferson Library and get a copy of this and read it. It was called One Wish, which she distributed to her husband's influential friends. Quote, it was Jefferson who had faith in man, she wrote. It was he who fought for a new government. It was he who built an asylum for the oppressed of all nations. In that instance, I think asylum is a poor choice of words there. Refuge probably would have been a better choice of words. It was he who caused the separation of church and state. It was he who spoke the first words in behalf of the freedom of the Negroes. Unquote. Jefferson belonged not only to the American people, she continued, quote, but to the people of all the world wherever liberty is. Pretty strong language, huh? Her one wish, that in order to properly honor Thomas Jefferson, quote, the nation whom he loved so well would purchase and preserve forever the house and grounds and graveyard at Monticello, so that Americans would be free to lay upon his grave a nation's tears. I know it gets really flowery, but every now and then in little snippets, I love the language from back then. I know it's too much for us nowadays, so you only want a little bit of it at a time. The response to Littleton's missive was electric, but a very large obstacle stood in the way. And remember, she was talking about the nation, the country, purchasing Monticello. That impediment was Jefferson Monroe Levy, Monticello's owner. He wasn't interested in selling. Kind of bothersome. The following year, Mrs. Littleton founded the Monticello Memorial Association. So this is the first incarnation. And lobbied Congress to acquire the property. The fight to secure Jefferson's home as a national shrine was on. That struggle will consume many more years and the fundraising efforts of dozens of individuals worldwide. Nationwide. Unfortunately, Littleton's organization died in the process, but its standard, the One Wish, was picked up and carried to victory by the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation, her philosophical inheritor. And notice that, how many years ago did they drop Memorial from it? Maybe 10, 15? 10 years ago? So the new incarnation is the Thomas Jefferson Foundation. We can talk about this afterwards, but memorial implies something that doesn't work with historical accuracy all that well. Think about it. The organization overcame seemingly insurmountable obstacles during its early years and in the process reintroduced to America the Virginian whose life and principles guided our revolution and shaped our republic. In the first two decades of the 20th century, several unsuccessful attempts had been made to purchase Monticello from Levy. In the early months of 1923, however, the time finally seemed right. The Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation, TJMF, was incorporated in Albany, New York on April 13, 1923. Does that date sound familiar? The Sage of Monticello's 180th birthday. The nonprofit organization was set up according to its 1926 report, quote, for the purpose of establishing Monticello as a memorial to the author of the Declaration and inculcating through patriotic education a better understanding and appreciation of the life and service of Thomas Jefferson, unquote. Formal announcement of the organization's existence appeared in the April 5th edition of the New York Times. In Charlottesville, the foundation's plans were first elaborated to a crowd of 500 assembled for Founders Day exercises in Cabell Hall at the University of Virginia. The foundation's original composition was an eclectic joining of North and South, Democrat and Republican, along with a healthy dash of Eastern Europe. Stuart G. Gibney and Henry Allen Johnston were Virginians, both graduates of the University of Virginia Law School, and both prominent New York City attorneys. Does that make sense? Gibney became the organization's first president, Johnston its secretary. Vice President Moses H. Grossman was a wealthy New York City judge, a man willing to put his money behind his beliefs. The first board of governors included UVA President Dr. Edwin Alderman. That makes a lot of sense. Thomas E. Rush, president of the National Democratic Club. Charles D. Hiles, vice chairman of the Republican National Committee. Virginia Governor E. Lee Trinkle. And New York City native Theodore Roosevelt. Neat, huh? The first treasurer was Charles D. Makepeace, vice president of the Seaboard National Bank. So a lot of heavy hitters on that board, huh? Russian-born Jew Theodore Fred Cooper became Gibney's general assistant, working almost as an advertising man, and subsequently served as the foundation's lawyer. So they got all these lawyers, but they picked this guy, and he's Russian-born. A native of Moscow, Fred Cooper later told Monticello curator James A. Baer Jr. that he had, quote, gotten off the boat at Ellis Island with only a single bag in his hand. That's all he had with him, unquote. Cooper's zeal and creativity were put to good use during the organization's early years. The Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation established its headquarters in New York at 115 Broadway, a building that by no coincidence also housed Judge Grossman's office and the Lawyers Club. Very convenient, huh? There's probably a bar downstairs, too. Office manager Jack Slate had worked as a newspaper editor of the New York World and as Teddy Roosevelt's public relations advisor. A self-perpetuating board of nine directors was put in place to run the corporation. All other members comprised the board of governors, which acted in an advisory capacity. A constitution and a set of bylaws were drafted, educational and fundraising committees were formed, but the most important task at hand, of course, was negotiating for the purchase of Jefferson's home from the ponderously named Jefferson Monroe Levy. What a name, huh? Who was Jefferson Monroe Levy? How had he come to acquire what Littleton called Jefferson's treasure house? The story is, and I know y'all at Monticello sometimes tell this story, but I love this story. The story is jam full of odd twists and turns and plenty of fascinating characters. Jefferson Monroe Levy was the fourth private individual to own Monticello since it passed out of the Jefferson family hands in 1831. The fourth. In November of that year, title to the property was conveyed to Charlottesville druggist James Turner Barclay, who was interested in setting up a silkworm culture using Jefferson's mulberry trees along Mulberry Row. That experiment failed within a few years. On May 20th, 1836, Monticello was purchased by 44-year-old U.S. Navy Lieutenant Uriah Phillips Levy. The Jewish gentleman admired Jefferson for his stance on religious freedom. 4 years earlier, Levy had written that Jefferson, quote, did much to mold our republic in a form in which a man's religion does not make him ineligible for political or governmental life, unquote. Levy spent a considerable amount of money repairing and maintaining Monticello. Uriah Levy, who, by the way, became the first Jewish commodore in the United States Navy. Uriah Levy died in 1862, leaving Jefferson's Little Mountain first to the people of the United States. Okay, that's kind of confusing. His intention was that Monticello be converted into an agricultural school for the orphaned sons of U.S. Navy warrant officers. Whew! As if anticipating problems. Gee, you think there'd be problems with that? I mean, exactly who owns this? As if anticipating problems, Levy's will stipulated two alternate benefactors. The Commonwealth of Virginia. Okay, so if it doesn't work out that we get it to the sons, orphan sons of warrant officers, then the state of Virginia will own it. Okay, so first the federal government, the Navy, then the state of Virginia, and then the Hebrew congregations of New York, Philadelphia, and Richmond. Talk about a messy will, huh? He probably should have had a lawyer help him out with that will, don't you think? What a mess. That same year, it gets even messier. That same year, 1862, the estate was seized by the Confederate States government as alien property as part of the Confiscation Act. After all, it had been the property of a enemy commodore, right? Ironically, and I love this piece of the story, and I haven't been able to get more about this. Maybe if I find this connection, I'll write about this. Ironically, Jefferson's youngest grandchild, George Wythe Randolph, was Confederate States Secretary of War at the time. I know there's a connection. I know there's a connection, but I can't prove it right now. On November 17, 1864, Monticello was sold at auction to Benjamin Franklin Ficklin of Albemarle County. Ficklin was a VMI graduate and the founder of the Pony Express. His ownership terminated at the end of hostilities, of course, as the property had been confiscated illegally. So at the end of the Civil War, all of that became null and void. The confiscation was illegal. The sale at auction was illegal, right? The nation's woes subsided in 1865, but Monticello's were just beginning. During the war, Levy's widow and other heirs had petitioned the New York State Supreme Court to declare the will null and void. That makes a whole lot of sense, doesn't it? The court ruled in their favor, saying the beneficiaries were not easily identifiable. The U.S. Attorney General concurred. Now the problem was how to divide up Jefferson's property. To which of the levy heirs did it belong? The Circuit Court of the City of Richmond decreed that the home and 218 acres be sold in order to settle the arguments over the will. When Monticello was finally sold on March 20th, 1879, for $10,500. Boy, those were the days, huh? The purchaser was Jefferson Monroe Levy, Uriah Levy's nephew. The wealthy 27-year-old had previously assured his uncontested ownership by buying out most of the other claimants. So that's the way to do it. Yeah, I'll give you a little bit of money if you end your claim against Monticello. While Monticello's fate was being argued in the courts, the house and property, including the graveyard, had unfortunately fallen into an awful state of disrepair. Levy installed a new ground superintendent and started the work of restoration. Quote, photographs of the pre-Levy period and those after his ownership, wrote Bear, James Bear, present conclusive evidence that his tenure was more than beneficial, unquote. Nonetheless, one of America's most historic homes soon became Levy's summer season getaway. Levy family portraits and naval memorabilia were put up on display. So it would have been a very different tour of Monticello back then. As the nation started seriously contemplating its origins, individuals began inquiring after Thomas Jefferson's home. Visitation grew steadily. William Jennings Bryan offered to purchase the estate in 1897, he who ran for political office a number of times. But his overtures were rebuffed. Mrs. Littleton first visited Monticello in 1909 and found the experience very disappointing. Quote, I had a heavy-hearted feeling, she wrote. There was nothing of Jefferson. He had dropped out and the Levies had come. Does Levy want a whole nation crawling at his feet forever for permission to worship at this shrine of independence? Unquote. Littleton lobbied for purchase by the federal government, but the movement failed. Levy was adamant about retaining the property. Quote, and I love this quote, this is from Levy. When the White House is for sale, then I will consider an offer for Monticello. Of course, the irony is the White House has always been for sale, right? The recession that followed World War I, however, accomplished what Littleton could not. In 1919, because of financial losses, Jefferson Monroe Levy advertised Monticello and 650 surrounding acres for sale. The price was $400,000. Two other patriotic groups were organized in Richmond and Washington, but were unable to come up with the money. Enter the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation. In January of 23, Levy asked a friend to inform New York Judge Moses H. Grossman that he was hard-pressed for money and forced to sell. Grossman had been in touch with the other associations and knew they would be willing to cooperate. Finally, the timing was right for Monticello's preservation, and its preservation appeared to be on the minds of many. The American Institute of Architects noted in a March 14, 23 report, quote, the private ownership of Monticello continues to be regrettable, but much more so is the bad condition into which the house and especially the outbuildings have fallen. It is hoped that the efforts to purchase the home for the public may be prosecuted with greater success and that the much-needed work of maintenance and repair be undertaken at once. Once formed, the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation went to work with a passion. Fred Cooper, during a trip to Richmond and Washington, was successful in bringing on board the other organizations. So this is how they got it. They got everybody together. Gibney, Makepeace, and Johnston were elected to an executive committee with the express purpose of negotiating with Levy. But the 71-year-old drove a hard bargain. After all, he was a lawyer. Quote, a number of conferences were held before the best possible terms were reached. The final price, $500,000. A payment of $100,000 in December of 23 at which point the title would exchange hands, a second payment of like sum, and the balance of $300,000. This is a lot of money in 1923. And the balance of $300,000 to be paid over a number of years with bonds of the foundation secured by a second mortgage. To seal the arrangement, Gibney, and this is to show you how hard up Levy was for money. To seal the arrangement, Gibney and Grossman wrote personal checks to Levy totaling $10,000. So the man was absolutely desperate for cash. Now the problem was raising $90,000 in 8 months. On April 23rd, 23, Manny Strauss was elected chairman of the Foundation Ways and Means Committee. Meeting the first payment was Strauss's goal, and several schemes to that effect were quickly announced. A spiritual pilgrimage from New York City to the Little Mountain was held in a stationary train parked in Grand Central Station. And here comes a story of all of these crazy schemes, and I think they're just fascinating. A stationary train, okay? While movies were shown of an actual trip to Monticello in the train, right? New York Senator Royal S. Copeland, dressed as a ticket agent, passed through the cars selling tickets at 1 cent a mile. The results were disappointing. Kind of a crazy idea, don't you think? Next, an underwriter's program was adopted wherein Gibney and Strauss procured promissory notes for amount of $1,000 or multiples thereof. In July 1923, George G. Battle, chairman of the foundation's finance committee, told the newspapers that the foundation's ultimate goal was $1 million. Half to acquire Jefferson's home and half to endow it. Quote, he appealed to the nation to square its debt with the author of the Declaration of Independence, hoping that Monticello would be an inspiration to the people and a mirror of their gratitude. Unquote. But the immediate debt was still short. Strauss next organized a fundraising transcontinental speaking tour. Virginia Governor Trinkle and UVA President Alderman and others were to address audiences in 25 different cities. That's pretty ambitious. But as it turned out, both of these men were far too busy. Cooper, remember the guy born in Moscow? Cooper would have to do all the talking himself. So the diminutive lawyer, quote, moved out across the West and South, speaking as many as 7 times a day. That's like giving tours at Monticello, often in areas very hostile to Jeffersonian ideas. Unquote. Cooper developed a very effective speech using Jefferson's epitaph. And you can imagine, he's going to do it 7 times a day very quickly. You know, he memorizes a script, right? He uses the epitaph, quote, author of the Declaration of American Independence, of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia, using this to reveal how the statesman had thus defined America's loftiest principles, personal freedom, religious freedom, education. Isn't that beautiful? It's so short and sweet. But, recalled Cooper, quote, Jefferson did not open the purse strings of people with real money. Even among people of modest means, he was a forgotten man. When the $90,000 was paid in December 1923, it was made up mostly of funds borrowed from banks on the basis of the pledges. So they're on shaky ground. Jefferson Monroe Levy cried during the ceremony in which the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation took possession of Monticello. According to Cooper, Levy, quote, said that he never dreamt he would ever part with the property, unquote. Jefferson Monroe Levy died the following March, but his heiress held true to the terms of the agreement. The foundation now held title to Monticello, but the amount of money still owed was overwhelming. The task seemed insurmountable. A 1924 report to the American Institute of Architects warned, in fact, that should the foundation fail in its mission, it would be many years before another group would take up the challenge. But there were other challenges as well. The estate had to be supervised, and a visitation system had to be established. Gibney and Cooper traveled to Monticello in order to begin the reorganization. The price of admission was set at 50 cents. What is it nowadays? $25. It's gone up a little bit. It's 50 times what it was. Governor Trinkle, U.S. Senator Copeland, and UVA President Alderman were appointed custodians to administer the property. Levy superintendent was kept on, but the levy memorabilia was removed, much to the chagrin of the family. But what did they expect? That a portrait of Levy was going to stay in the entrance hall? I mean, come on. It's a little crazy, huh? Simultaneously, as part of its dual purpose of preservation and education, the foundation began looking for ways to promote the, quote, basic democratic ideals which Jefferson served and championed. But in the early 1920s, there were no new biographies of Jefferson. And the textbooks, and all of this is very hard for me to believe, and the textbooks mentioned him merely as president and author of the Declaration. So third president, author of the Declaration, move on to the next guy. Quote, for these reasons, wrote Cooper, we plan to direct the campaign on an educational basis through the children and their teachers, unquote. The foundation's programs over the next few years consisted mainly of special events. These publicity stunts, and wait till you hear these stunts, raised money but also raised the public awareness of Jefferson and his life. Jefferson's birthday celebrations, for example, were inaugurated in public schools, the accumulated gifts going toward the preservation of the property. Quote, we hope the people in every state of the Union will respond generously to our appeal, stated Gibney in a March 24 issue of The World, and make certain the early completion of the purchase fund. New York Governor Alfred E. Smith was the first of many officials to set aside April 6th through 13th as Jefferson Week, a whole week, not just a day. The foundation provided free transportation from New York City to Monticello on the actual birthday. Just get more people down here. Get them down here. 50 boys and girls toured the home and the university, all the while taking notes from the information presented by the guides. The foundation moved forward on other fronts as well. UVA architecture professor Fisk Kimball was made chairman of the Monticello Restoration Committee in 1924. The longtime director of the Philadelphia Museum of Art was the perfect man for the job. Eminently knowledgeable on Jefferson's career as an amateur architect, Kimball, as member of the Preservation Committee of the American Institute of Architects, had long supported the movement to purchase and preserve Monticello. The World reported in 25 that Kimball hoped, quote, not only to restore the lawns and gardens, but also to return to the historic mansion much of the furniture bought by the author of the Declaration of Independence. In these endeavors, Kimball was successful and even acquired Jefferson pieces from some of the ex-president's descendants. Kimball continued to serve Monticello until 1954 as the 100th anniversary of Jefferson's death on July 4, 1826 approached. A centennial committee was set up to organize an observance. The committee conducted an election in which the candidates, all young ladies, who received 50,000 votes would win a July 1926 trip to Paris. Not just to Monticello, but to Paris. That's pretty cool. The votes, cost 10 cents. So the ladies each needed to raise $5,000 to win. Quote, Cooper arranged the tours in France to be educational, especially from the standpoint of democratic ideals, unquote. Complaints were voiced against an election where the votes were purchased. Why? Lots of elections have votes purchased. But the New York Times strongly supported the idea. 58 girls toured France as a result of the campaign that netted over $300,000 for Monticello. That one worked, didn't it? 58 young ladies. The year 26 saw several other special events staged by the foundation. On February 17th, all of New York City's school children rose and repeated the foundation's Patriots Pledge of Faith, a pledge to the fundamental ideas set forth in the Declaration. Quote, and here comes part of it. As you can imagine, what was the year, 26, you can imagine what this sounds like. Quote, "And as an evidence of my gratitude for the blessings which that immortal document has assured, I do hereby make this contribution for the preservation of Monticello as a national memorial to the author of the Declaration of Independence and as a patriotic shrine for the children of America." Pretty amazing, huh? The youngsters of New York City thus donated $34,864. Pretty amazing. For the 150th anniversary celebration of the signing of the Declaration, one of Jefferson's carriages was driven from Charlottesville to Philadelphia in a reenactment of his historic 1776 trip. Thomas Jefferson Randolph IV, the sage of Monticello's great-great-grandson, wrote a letter to the foundation authenticating the vehicle as his ancestor's one-horse gig. It was actually a two-horse phaeton that Jefferson had designed in 1805. So it wasn't even from the right time period, and it wasn't even the right vehicle. Representatives from various American cities joined the procession, which made a brief stopover in Washington so that President Calvin Coolidge could make a donation. Through the staging of these and other campaigns, the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation was able to announce in the September 22, 1928 issue of the New York Herald that only $28,500 of the debt remained. The Great Depression, as you can imagine, caused the foundation to cut back staff and hugely affected its ability to retire the debt. The last payments, however, were made in 1940. But those first few years were the most important. In negotiating with Jefferson Monroe Levy and raising what was then astronomical amounts of money, the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation accomplished what's been called a stupendous task. And they brought the sage of Monticello a portion of his rightful due. The foundation was determined, according to James Baer, quote, "to popularize Jefferson and make Monticello a national shrine." Here, they were eminently successful, unquote. These goals were achieved with perseverance and no little dab of creativity. Quote, "So you see, we had plenty of corny stunts," remembered Fred Cooper in 1971, "but Monticello was saved." Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.